Okay, it's now 1 o'clock, so I'd like to, or I should say 11 o'clock in Edmonton and 1 o'clock where I'm at, but we're ready to get started, so I'd like to say hello everyone and welcome. My name is Lynn Anderson and I'll be moderating today's CIDR session. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone that all of the CIDR sessions, including this one, are recorded and available from the CIDR site, and I will post the link to the CIDR site in the text box so that you can access that if you want to review the recordings, or if you want to send that on to somebody who couldn't make it today, that would be great too. The PowerPoint presentation will also be available at that site and an MP3 recording of this session. I'd also like to point out that we're using a newer version of Illuminate. I think most of the people here are getting familiar with it, but I'll run through it quickly again for those of you who are new to this platform. Oops, sorry. Now, throughout this session and afterwards, there's going to be opportunities to share questions and comments, and you can do that using the, I'll show you the audio window that you can see there by clicking on the microphone icon and speaking, and then just please remember to click on that again when you're done talking, as that'll release the microphone for other people. And you can adjust your audio levels, the microphone and the speakers, using the dials next to the microphone icon right there. Now, there's also a chat window that you can use throughout this session to send messages to the group or to everyone in the entire room or to individuals. If you want to send a message to an individual in the room, it will remain private. And you can find those individuals using there's a little drop-down arrow here where it says, right beside where it says this room, you can choose to send a message just to an individual and text that in. If you don't have audio today and you prefer to using the text, I'll be attempting to redirect any questions in the text box to Jeff. But if the text is scrolling really quickly, we may have to wait on that. Finally, in the participant window, there's a few icons in there you can use, emoticons to indicate your feelings during this session, and there's also a little hands up icon. So if you do have a question or comment that you want to ask Jeff about, you can click on the hands up icon, and that indicates to us that you're waiting to make a comment. Also, at the very top in the menu bar, there's a little, get a little closer, a little icon that allows you to rearrange the window in whatever layout you prefer, and I encourage you to do that and play with that right now. Finally, as the session closes today and as you're leaving, whenever you leave this Illuminate session, a survey will pop up, and I would really appreciate you taking a moment. It's a very short survey. Fill that out and give us some feedback on this session. It also gives Illuminate a little bit of feedback on the platform. So we will hopefully get some information on for upcoming CIDR sessions that we can use from that. Now, it's always fun to see where everyone's coming from in Illuminate, and we can get a visual by pinpointing our location on the map I have here. You can let us know where you're coming from by clicking on the little icon that looks like a wand beside Alaska there, and then clicking on the map where you're coming from, and you'll see there's little mines appearing all over the map. Oops, sorry. Showing us where everybody is. Mostly Canada today. Oh, a few from the States. Great. Now, I'm very pleased to introduce our presenter for today's session, Dr. Jeffrey Rollet. Jeff is an associate professor of mathematics education and applications of ICT in teaching and learning at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. He's been using ICT to support teaching and learning since the early 80s when he was a high school teacher in Timmins, Ontario. And he later supported his colleagues in this endeavor as both a mentor and as a consultant for the Timmins Board of Education. He eventually joined the Ontario Ministry of Education in the Mid-Northern Regional Office, where he served as education officer and was responsible for ICT and education for all subjects and grades, and he was very heavily involved in bringing computer conferencing to schools in that area. in the late 80s and early 90s, Jeff decided to continue his own formal education by completing his master's and doctoral degrees in education at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. Now, much of his master's degree was completed online, and this heightened his interest in the potential for computer conferencing to support collective learning. As a result, Jeff conducted research on processes and structures that supported extended deep conversations online. At Queen's University, Jeff has continued his research into ICT and teaching and learning mathematics, particularly collaborative online investigations and the use of internet for collective construction, for the collective construction of knowledge. Today he's going to be sharing his research on the interactions that take place in asynchronous online conferences with us. And now I'll release the mic to you, Jeff, and let you get started on that. Thank you very much for coming to our CIDR session.
Thank you for the introduction, Lynn. And good afternoon from Ontario. Good morning for the people that are out in the further out in the west. I'm going to pause it a few times during the session, just if there are any questions or comments people would like to make. But if your in question doesn't coincide with the pause, then please feel free to raise your hand so I know that there is a question, and if you want to type the question into the chat box, that would help. So let me get started here. I'm interested in the communication in asynchronous learning networks. That's come under a number of different titles: computer conferencing, computer mediated communication, etc. Over the years, but now asynchronous learning networks seems to be a pretty common term for this. And I'm interested in how this communication contributes to the building of collective knowledge and individual knowledge. And what I want to do today is look at a couple of studies that were conducted by myself over a 20-year span, or almost 20 years, because they suggest to me some things haven't changed too much in 20 years, and certainly not haven't changed to the extent that some of the commentators on e-learning and just the web and web 2.0, etc., would have us believe. The two studies involved computer conferencing, as we called it back then in 1987, in a system called Participate that was running on OISE's computer in Toronto. And then 19 years later or so, during the winter term of 2006, discussion in a master's course using the WebCT discussion tool. Both of these studies have appeared in publications, actually proceedings of conferences, one back in 1990 when I reported on the 87 study, and in 2008 when I reported on the 2006. What I want to do today is sort of put these two together, because I think that putting them together suggests, as I say, that some things to be looked at. Since the studies are historical, or have a historical, maybe I'd give a little personal history, although Lynn has given most of these details. But I was, she's a mathematics and computer science teacher in a high school setting in Northern Ontario. And in that, I bought my first computer in 1980, which I suspect may be before some of the people in the session here were born. My students are always impressed that there were such things as computers back in those days. And I was got myself online by joining an email for the system that Bell Telephone had at the time called Envoy 100 in 1983. And as I said, I did the worked in the Ministry of Education for a few years as an education officer supporting computers in teaching and learning, or ICT as it's now called, in all the grades and all the subjects at JK to 12 in Northern Ontario. But my introduction to computer-mediated communication, computer conferencing, was through an M.Ed. program, 1986 to 1990, when I took half the courses online. but they were, in those days, it was not by the web, in that the internet didn't, well, actually did exist, but wasn't a publicly accessible device. So it was direct phone connection to the VAX computer mainframe that at OISE, where the computer conferencing system was existing. And as subsequent to that, I, as Lynn said, completed my doctorate at OISE and moved to Queens to teach in the Faculty of Education. And I teach a couple courses of interest to people maybe here. One, a B.Ed. course in which is called Teaching and Learning Online, in which teacher candidates look at the potential uses of the web, both in classrooms, intact classrooms, and also for online credit courses. And I teach some of my M.Ed. courses. Queens doesn't have an M.Ed. online M.Ed. program as such, but some of us teach our courses online, and I have done that for the last few years. It might also help to just have some picture of my epistemological position. I take a social constructivist view of knowledge. That is, I think knowledge, I see knowledge as being constructed by individuals through their interaction with the environment, and in particular also, especially in school settings, through interactions with other humans. So knowledge is constructed, and it is constructed, or a good part of it is constructed, in social interactions. This is important, I think, for looking at what I'm talking about in terms of online communication and knowledge construction. Just a, very quickly, what my in graphical terms, a group of people come together with around some issue with individual understandings, and in their discussions, could be online or face to face, contribute parts of their that individual understanding to a pool. And through a series process of negotiation, discussion, we get a collective understanding emerging. Now, this collective understanding is not equal to any one of these individual understandings, but it has some connections to this. There's a considerable overlap by the time if we've had effective collective development of collective understanding. There's considerable overlap between the individual understandings and what the group has come to understand. This image of learning is, in fact, the underlies the idea of asynchronous learning networks as a book that I use quite often, Learning Together, Research in Asynchronous Learning Networks, edited by Hiltz and Goldman, in a paper in that. Three of the authors state, the pedagogical assumption that students learn by constructing knowledge through group interaction is a theoretical foundation of asynchronous learning networks. So there's a compatibility between ALNs and the epistemological position that I'm taking. When we look at this process of construction of group or collective knowledge or collective understanding, we see it's a complex evolutionary process, a process that is often compared to the biological evolutionary processes, and people studying this have adopted quite a bit of the language that comes out of biological evolution or studies of that, in particular the idea of complexity science. And I've been using complexity science to, in the last 6-7 years or so, to take a look at a number of things in my research, but in particular at the conversations, the communication that occurs online. When we look at complexity science, it suggests that there's sort of four ingredients or four things that need to be present to have effective construction of whatever the end product is, or evolution of the end product, in this case of some collective knowledge. There needs to be decentralized control. That is, everyone in terms of a conference, that all people feel free to make contributions to the central pool of knowledge or ideas. There has to be neighbor interactions, active exchange of ideas. Just throwing them in the pool doesn't suffice. Other people have to pick them up and work with them, respond to them. There needs to be redundancy among agents. That is, there needs to be some overlap of the ideas. If everyone in the group's opinion on some issue is totally opposed, there's no commonality, or there's just no common view at all, then conversation is a lot likely to proceed. And finally, we need to have some internal diversity or divergence of opinion to generate a reasonable debate. As Terry has pointed out, there's at the University of Alberta right now, there's a journal on complexity in education. This idea of complexity science, these ideas, as well, Brent Davis and Dennis Samara are at Alberta now, we're at Alberta, I should say, and are now at Calgary, University of Calgary, and they've been sort of major players in this idea of bringing the ideas of complexity science to the study of education. So I'm going to use these ideas here, and in fact, I'm going to put up the findings the data I've collected, analyze it, or look at it from this point of view, looking for these four items that are considered necessary for an evolution of an idea or collective knowledge. So let me just pause there for a second if there are any questions. I'm just going to click off the microphone in case anybody wants to pick it up.
I'm not sure about questions, but we did have a couple of people respond to the courses that you're teaching with interest. And if you can get back to them perhaps at the end of the session about your courses, that would be useful. I think we're good, Jeff. Most of the texting that was going on was interactions as opposed to questions and comments. So unless Joanne's got one here, you're free to go ahead.
I was just wondering when the polarities of opinions are, so that no further discussion goes ahead, is sometimes related about knowing how to deal with maybe feelings of the right brain rather than just ideas, and how to keep people online able to maybe not take things personally so that they can continue constructive discussion.
Yeah, well, in fact, I mean, what I'm going to point out later on has something to do with what you're suggesting there in terms of the social domain and the emotional part of this, and making sure that people aren't offended, or in fact, I guess the reverse is what I'm finding is that people are probably a little too cautious in that domain. So maybe I'll leave that, and we can pick that up at the end of the session, if that's okay. So if we want to study the construction of knowledge in, well, any domain, but in particular online, through a conversation, then we're really talking about sort of discourse analysis, looking very closely at the conversation and dissecting it into conversation units, contributions that people make, and the interaction between those contributions. This is not an easy task. It's time consuming because you have to look through the conference very carefully and read things. And so we're rather limited in size of studies, but we're also interested in really the interactions in small groups, not very large conferences in terms of numbers. So the two samples I have are small in size. What I've hoped is that to continue this in other settings and also pool with other people our knowledge in exactly what the discourse is online and the interaction between contributions. There's a lot of research about concerning online conversations, online conferencing, has taken a statistical point of view, letting the computer count things like time online, frequency of visits, number of postings, etc. Number of times a particular comment is read and such and replied to. That data is valuable, but it doesn't get, in many cases, to the heart of the conversation. And the work I'm doing goes deeper than that, looks right at the individual postings and looks at what they have to say. The content is stripped out in terms of the particular issue, but the relationship between the posts, between the messages, is retained and looked at. Discourse analysis, of course, is not unique to online situations. There's been lots of work in studying conversations over the years in the face-to-face settings. And my view is that while face-to-face is not the same as online, a good place to start at least is with some of the tools, the methodologies that people have developed for that location, face-to-face, and see if we can migrate them and use them effectively and modify them if necessary for the online situation. This also allows us to compare face-to-face with online as well, if we're using somewhat similar methodologies. And when I started doing this back in the 1980s, I found a system called methodology called the Interact System Model, developed by Fisher and outlined by him in a book, Small Group Decision Making, Communication and the Group Process, the second edition of which came out in 1980. And I adopted Fisher's ISM as a technique for doing analysis. And just to walk you through it quickly so that we can then go on and you'll understand where the data comes from in these conferences. Okay, in the ISM, we're looking at ACTS. ACTS are conversation units with a single focus or purpose. In face-to-face conversation, an ACT is usually one utterance is an ACT. People take turns in responding to each other, and they tend to confine each response or each utterance to a single issue or single ACT. Of course, as you all know, having, I'm sure, participated in online conferences, that isn't the case necessarily in that environment. People's postings often address a number of issues that have been addressed in messages higher up the conference or previous messages. And so an individual message may not be a single act. In fact, it's often more than one act. An interact is a pair of linked acts. So in face-to-face conversations, they often are, in fact, sequential in time. One person A makes a statement and person B responds right after that. And that is an interact because the response is, in fact, addressed to the first utterance, the first conversation unit. But in the online situation, as you know, there's a lot of threading of conversations in a conference because people, it's asynchronous, they sign on at different times, and so a tenth message may not, in fact, respond to the ninth message in the sequence, but may respond to messages above that. So one of the tasks is to identify which they respond to, but having identified the various acts and which previous acts they're linked to. An interact is these pair of acts, one relating to the other, and the type of relationship between the two acts. And Fisher used this coding, and I've adopted his coding to just to consistency. Ones that are coded one are fairly simple responses, really interpretations, more along the line of just somebody saying, I agree with John in his comment and message such as, because in a very simple response, just elaborating a little bit. Substantiation takes that further in which one responds, but then if, let's say, I disagree with Mary's previous statement, and here are the reasons, and I present evidence either from personal experience or possibly cite a journal article or something that backs up my particular position. And these could be favorable or unfavorable, in other words, I could disagree. They also sometimes are ambiguous by not by mixing both sides of the issue, and sometimes they're ambiguous by being neutral without really coming out and saying what position I'm taking. Beyond that, there's category three, which are clarification, which just expands on a previous act but doesn't evaluate it, and modification, which takes the comments in a previous act and alters them in some ways, maybe adds details and actually changes them. Then five and six are more like polling, just straight votes, I agree or disagree. And seven, social structuring, is something I added because, in fact, Fisher didn't seem to need them, and he probably didn't because he was talking about face-to-face conversations where the social environment was sort of already there to some extent established, whereas online sometimes we need messages to actually establish some social connections. So some of the acts that I have identified are listed as category seven. So the process of analysis is to go through the messages in the conference and break them down into individual conversation acts. As I said, often messages contain more than one act because they're responding to multiple messages further up the conference, or possibly having two or three responses to the same message in separate segments of the message, but not submitted separately. Because the various strands of the conversation are mixed, blended as the conference goes on, there's also a need to identify the different strands or themes that have emerged in this conference and assign the acts to the various strands to which they belong. So in other words, what we're doing is taking the conversation, which is threaded and blended, out and trying to put it in separate sequences of acts about particular identifiable themes. Once the acts have been assigned to their various themes or strands, then it's a matter of going through, and they're in sequence now, and looking at the how they connect to each other. In other words, how a 10th act connects to an act previous to it. It may be the 9th, but it may in fact be one further up the conversation. And in reading carefully and looking at it, assigning one of the labels that Fisher's used, the 1F, 1U, etc., that I showed in the previous slide. Once all that's done, I'm doing this in Excel actually, but my students are with me. It tells us a lot, but really is very difficult to read. So we then plot this data. Fisher used a technique called contiguity analysis matrices, and I've used those, and they do tell us some things, but I found of late it's much easier to see what's happening, or at least get a picture of what's happening, by actually creating flowcharts of the interact strands. That flowchart gives us some picture of the clustering, the length of conversations, if there are key acts that stimulated a new thread, and the types of relationships between the various acts. And just to give you a picture from one of the samples that I've analyzed, in the 2006 course, that was a series of seminars online. There were seven participants, seven students, I should say, and I coded them with these colors, and the instructor, which happened to be myself. And after doing all that analysis and plotting it, I get this picture. Sorry, I skipped a couple slides there. This picture, which I'm sure you can't read at all in any detail, but requires blowing up on a computer to get much out of it. But what we have here are the strands and then well, actually, these are themes, and then they've broken into some sub-strands. The colors are the contributors, and the arrows show the interacts. And you can't see them, but on each arrow, there's a label which from Fisher's interact analysis that actually tells us what type of interact it is, what type of relationship there is between the two messages. Okay. And Lynn has a question, or Suzanne, and I'm going to pause right now because I think this is a good place to pause. And if anybody's got any questions about the technique I'm using before I actually present the data that...
Hi, Jeff. That's exactly why I stopped you there, because there were quite a number of questions coming across as you were talking about your methods. So I'm going to just open up the mic and allow people to readdress those questions to Jeff using the audio right now, please.
Hi, Jeff. It's Terry. I think it's a fascinating method. I was just wondering about the reliability issue, whether you can identify the number of instances within one message. You said it isn't as easy because the turn-taking that happens in face-to-face the way Fisher did it, but was it easy, and could you do it reliably with multiple coders, or did you try that to actually find out how many instances there were in a single message? The post?
You're absolutely right. The reliability is a problem and interpretation is a problem. The first study I looked at, I did it myself alone, but subsequent studies, since I've come to Queens and had access to graduate students, we've done this collectively, and I would say about 80% of the messages or so, there's agreement with the group that there's three acts in this message, and they relate to these other acts, they fit in these particular strands, and here's what the relationship is. There's another 20-15% or so in which we have to spend some time debating and sort of come to consensus. As all discourse analysis, I think pretty well it comes down to eventually the coding is always somewhat iffy, I guess you could put it simply, and that it does require at least one person's opinion, and possibly a group. With a group, at least you've got some checks and balances. For a certain number of messages, it's not totally clear what the particular relationship is.
There was also some questions as to what software you use, or the software that you use to do this.
Yeah, well, the software is pretty simple. I mean, this is a smart idea. It's just a concept mapping software, which I'm using to display the work. It would be nice to have some type of automated processing, I suppose, but I haven't found one or haven't developed one at all. So it's a matter of collecting the conference itself and as a PDF document, reading through it on paper and doing the marking it up, putting the data into an Excel spreadsheet, and then eventually plotting them by hand or electronically in this format here using Smart Ideas, since it is available and to us and reasonably simple to use. Any other questions? Says that Brent said UBC. Actually, I think Brent has now finally moved to made his full move to Calgary and is resident there. Although knowing Brent, I can see him shuffling off to somewhere else, and in a short while he seems to hop around pretty regularly. Okay, if there are no other questions, then I'll just proceed on and actually show the data from these conferences and show some conclusions or some ideas that I've drawn from them, and a question really I've drawn, an issue that I think needs to be addressed. Just to clarify the context of the studies, the two data collection sessions. They were both online MEd courses, both conducted asynchronously. The one in 1987, the course was for people interested in computer-mediated communication, so it was conducted online and was about online interactions called Educational Applications of Computer-Mediated Communications. The 2006 study was a more general MEd course in addition to curriculum theory, where we look at philosophies and conceptions that underlie various approaches to curriculum over the, well, really since the turn of the century, well, I should say, since the early 1900s. The groups involved in 1987, there were four students without the instructor, because what they were was a subgroup of a class of 15 working on an assignment together. So the group had been had breakout groups, and four of them were in this group. In 2006, what we had were seven students and the instructor involved in both seminars. The durations were, well, in 1987, the group of four had 3 weeks, the weeks six, seven, and eight, so they'd had 5 weeks of interaction prior to this in the larger setting. But the for over 3 weeks, these four people worked together online on their task. In 2006, we were looking at seminar six, so in the sixth, these are week-long, or generally week-long seminars, so the course had been in play for about 5 weeks, and this was seminar six, a one-week seminar. And seminar seven, we spread over 2 weeks, partly because there were a few people who were going to be absent for part of that and are unavailable, so we spread it out over 2 weeks to make sure everybody could be involved. The tasks were different. The task for the group in 1987 was a decision-making task in that, or involved decisions, in that they had to produce a report that was given back to the full class of 15 on each group was looking at a different environment for online conferencing. This group, in fact, looked at the system called COSY, which was developed at the University of Guelph, and in fact eventually migrated to be the conferencing system that ended up in WebCT. This group did an examination of COSY and produced a report which reported on the affordances within COSY for online conferencing, online conversations. The seminar group in 2006, they didn't have to come to any common view or decision. What the task was here was to, well, prior to the seminars, read some papers that were assigned and discuss the ideas that came out of those papers. Seminar six was focused on critical theory, so we were looking at teachers and schools as possibly being critics of society. In other words, the issue is, does school exist? Is the purpose of an education and a curriculum to generate graduates who will change society and challenge society, or is it just to reflect the society as present? Seminar seven looked at the issue of morals, values, etc., ethics, and how they interact with the curriculum, and the issue of the religious community's influence on education. So they were, I think the important thing to notice, the tasks were different. This one was a decision-making task, and this one was, the task was really just to have a full discussion of some issues. And with that in mind, then we look at the conversation patterns. This is the 1987 decision-making task activity, and as you probably know, that online conversations regularly fracture into different themes, paths, threads. The 1987 one fractured because the people made, the four participants made different decision proposals, suggestions as to how the report might proceed, what might be reported in it, etc. They actually made 12 decision proposals. Two of them were not picked up by anybody. They just, the one participant made the proposal and they just sat dormant. So although there are 12 here, I'm actually only going to look, I'm only looking at 10 of them. The two that didn't go anywhere, just single act, were left out. These are the number of acts that apply to any one of these proposals. And you can see there's quite a range from 23 to a low of just one person making the proposal and one person responding with a single act. So in fact, there were two acts on that. It works out that for each proposal, we had an average of 2.5 acts per participant in respect to that proposal. The more important thing, I think, is to look at the span of the conversation and these acts. Since this was decision-making task, what we really would want and expect, and Fisher's work would suggest, is we would, in an effective conversation, we would have a decision proposal, then we would have a fairly intense conversation, a focused conversation about that proposal, and a decision being made as to whether or not we would go that direction. In fact, what we see is first the first decision proposal was made in the sixth message, and it still hadn't been resolved in the very last message, 110. And this is the same, this one, that the longest running conversation or thread, 23 acts. The initial proposal was made in message 19, and it was still alive in message 103. So what we see is that while there was interaction, the interaction didn't generate decision making. Most of these, as you can see, most of the decision proposals were still alive near the very end of the conversation, the conference, and in fact they got resolved by basically the person who was in charge of writing the putting together things in the final report, making a decision themselves as to what was going to be there and not. So not a failure in a conversation by any means, but not exactly what we would expect in a decision-making situation, and a totally successful one. Looking at the conversation patterns in the seminars, the same thing happens in that the seminar fractured into, well, in the case of the seminar six themes, and with a range of number of acts in them, and again an average of about the same, 2.23 acts per participant applying to each of these themes. What I think is important here is that this both seminars had one of the students as leader, whose task was to set the conversation started, but then later the idea was that other participants, of course, would be free to set different directions if they saw other themes or other things worth discussing coming out of the papers, that they would in fact contribute these and the conversations might go off in some other directions. But as we see, that in fact the first five messages were contributed in fact by the leader, and they set the themes, and only one other theme emerged, and it didn't emerge until the 49th act in the seminar. So there wasn't the leadership was held solely by the appointed leader, and other participants didn't see their position or didn't feel free to initiate, or at least didn't see a need to possibly initiate a slightly different direction in the conversation. The same thing is true in the seventh seminar. All the first eight threads in the conversation were all initiated by the student who was leading the seminar, and two other ones were initiated by other members of the group later on in the seminar. But the bulk of the leadership and the direction of where things would go was left in the hands of one person. So I would argue that the two seminars, again, while successful, could have been richer experiences. And I want to look at why they might not be as rich as they could be. Returning to the ideas of complexity science, the question is, were all these or any of these four features present? And if any were absent, could that be a reason for the conversations not being maybe as rich as they might be? And what I've done here is given you the interacts, the percentage of them in the three situations, the decision-making task from 1987 and the two seminars in 2006. This is Fisher's coding, and these are the percents of acts of various types. And what I want to do is focus on a couple things in here, and we'll do that by looking at a couple more slides. First of all, substantial interaction. In Fisher's analysis, one is just simple comments back. Five and six are just voting type things. I agree, I don't agree. Two are substantial acts. That is, ones that comment on a previous act and expand and give you reasons. I don't agree because the following reasons and some argument. Or three, which is a clarification, expands on a previous act, doesn't necessarily evaluate it, but expands on it. And four is one that does some modifications. So these things, two, three, and four, acts of those nature, are substantial in their responses to a previous conversation unit. And what we see is that almost three quarters of the acts were, in fact, of that nature. So I would say, I think I could argue, that in fact people were responding to each other and responding to each other in fairly substantial ways, not just making the offhand I agree type response. Looking at the issue of redundancy, there we would be looking at acts that Fisher labels as favorable, acts that are labeled F, 1F, 2F, or 5, which is the simple voting type thing, I agree type statement. What we see here is a preponderance of acts that fit in that category. In 1987, if you total those up, 71.4% of the acts were of this favorable response. When there was any feedback at all in two, it was to build the argument that had been previously given. Not quite as strong in the seminars, but still fairly strong. 36.9% of the acts are what we call favorable in seminar six, and 27.1% in seminar seven. So using the idea of redundancy, in other words here, it would appear as if there was a fair amount of common agreement about ideas in these acts, and that the redundancy that complexity science suggests is necessary is in fact there. On the other side, the question of diversity, it would appear as if there's a lack of diversity. There were a lack of unfavorable acts. Here we're looking at, I want to just compare here, we're looking at the acts labeled U or 6, which is an act which is just basically a simple statement of disagreement. And if we look at the numbers here, only 6.6% of the acts in 1987 could be labeled as unfavorable, that disagreed with some previous statement. That's compared to 71% that were favorable. In these first seminar, seminar six, in fact, there were no acts that suggested disagreement. And in the seminar seven, 6.5% of the acts were unfavorable. That's compared to 27.1% which were favorable. So there really seems to be a lack of unfavorable acts or a lack of diversity, which may just be the particular conferences or topics, but I think we could argue it might be otherwise. Going back to complexity science here, we see, I put a little check mark beside decentralized control, because it's not clear that in the two seminars everyone felt free. They certainly were free to, and they were informed they were free to, but they didn't take the opportunity to initiate different strands in the conversation. So whether or not there was decentralized control is somewhat questionable. There certainly were neighbor interactions. We saw there were three quarters of the interacts were of the substantial nature. There's certainly redundancy in that a large number of the acts were of the favorable nature. In other words, responded to a previous comment in a supportive agreement matter, and it just expanded on it. The question is, was there internal diversity? It appears that there wasn't, or at least wasn't stated. And that's what I think the importance of the research lies, and the question for me lies, because clearly there was some diversity in 1987. There were decision proposals made near the beginning of the conference, and they never were resolved. In the two seminars, the critical theory is a topic of some dispute and opportunity for debate. And certainly in Ontario, we've had some serious debates over the years about the funding of religious schools and such. So it's a topic that has potential for debate. So you would expect to have some diversity. Looking at this a little further, that question a little more, I decided to look at the ambiguous acts, ones marked AB and AN. And what you see is there's a significant number of them. More acts, 7.7% of the acts in the decision-making conference in 87, which was greater number than the unfavorable acts, or greater percentage. 23.3% ambiguous acts in the seminar 6, again greater than the number of unfavorable, and 15.9 in seminar 7, and again greater than the number of unfavorable. So what I'm suggesting is that we may have a situation where there is diversity, but it's hidden, that people aren't prepared to actually clearly state, I don't agree with somebody, and in a fairly explicit fashion, and instead want to mask that by using ambiguous interacts, ones that really don't come out. They might argue one side of the question and then do, on the other hand, sort of smooth out this possible opposition or the message that my views are opposed to somebody else's. So, as I was using the slide from before, again here, my question really is, are we lacking internal diversity? We're certainly lacking it in terms of being there explicitly, but is it a question that in fact there is diversity of opinion, but that people are just not prepared to express it fully in this environment? And as I've characterized this, is this a question of people just being too nice? Is it the case that, and I would argue it is, that participants were reluctant to express disagreement in a direct manner, so they used ambiguous postings, and that they weren't willing to assume their part of the leadership in the seminar, and leave it to the seminar leader to set the threads of the conversation, and in 2006 weren't prepared to actually say, I think we should discuss this, and set off another thread in the conversation. So my question to everybody is really, is this being too nice? Have other people observed it? And my observation is that it appears that lacking channels for social linking, such as tone of voice, facial expression, participants have this fear of, as I can't remember who asked the question earlier, of giving offense when they make a statement in bold text, or in text, not bold, but text that can be, looks fairly cold, of expressing disagreement with the idea of some posted by somebody else before. And so they tend to mask their disagreement with the ambiguous responses. And the result of that is that when we're looking at complexity science, that last degree ingredient that is necessary, the internal diversity, while it may be there in the background, really doesn't come out, and so it tends to stunt the development of an effective debate and conversation. So that's the conclusions I'm drawing from this, and I'd be interested in responses from and comments from anyone else. I'm going to click off the microphone here so somebody else can pick it up if they wish.
Jeff, there was a lot of discussion and questions in the text regarding the participants in your research as far as what their experience was in asynchronous conferencing situations and on as being online students, and there was questions as to culture and age and gender and all those types of variables that came into this research. Can you enlighten us on any of those?
Yeah, I can. Like, obviously, in 1987, they were the group was reasonably new to online conferencing since it hadn't been around for too long. Four people were active, very active users of computers in their teaching, and they were all teachers, and didn't experience technical problems of any significance while conferencing, but certainly it was a new environment for everybody in the course. I would think only a couple of people of the 15 in the course had done anything more. They had emailed prior to that, but hadn't been involved in computer conferences. In 2006, the group was were heavy users of email and such, but computer conferencing was, I think, to the group generally new. The age range, I think, is important. In 2006, while we were in the digital age, I would say that only one of the students would be considered what's sometimes called a digital native, somebody born and raised in the digital age, and she was a very active user of MSN and kept in touch with all her friends through that medium and Facebook and such. The other participants were somewhat older, and while all technically adept and comfortable with the technology side, certainly weren't, their lives had not, digital communication hadn't been, or online communication hadn't been a major part of their lives, in particular their social lives, up to this point, and so that this was a reasonably new experience for them. And I think that's important because my class this year was a totally different mix, all very young people, all products of the digital age. What they did online was quite different from the previous one. I don't think it was any better, but certainly was a different type of interaction than in the previous studies.
Jeff, I find this really interesting. I've also noticed the same thing of what Walter Archer, I see as here, termed pathological politeness that happens in formal education. And what was really interesting is that you do still see lots of flaming and attacks that happen in non-educational environments using the same technology, asynchronous text. But I'm wondering that whether you looked at any of Fisher's work in face-to-face environments, whether it's really a function of formal education and maybe the grading associated with it, or is it a function of the media? Like, how do these compare to analysis of face-to-face interactions in a classroom experience?
Well, Fisher, as his title of his book says, it was in decision-making situations, problem-solving, small group problem-solving. So he does look at the cycles of in the problem-solving process, and I don't. It's quite specific what he did. I did compare the first study, 1987, to his work, and saw the cycles he had in his studies didn't occur there. The two conferences that I looked at in 2006, of course, weren't decision-making, so that comparing them to what Fisher would expect is not quite as accurate, I think. I don't think it's totally the medium, the medium has an impact in terms of the inability of people in wanting to be nice and being polite only have text in which to do it, and so that is a bigger motivator to camouflaging disagreement. Lynn, I'm going to turn it over to you. I think that we're probably coming to our end of our time, and I'm prepared to talk to people further, but we should probably wrap it up for those that need to leave.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you so much for joining us today to share your research. I don't know if you saw in the text already, somebody had mentioned how important this work was, and I really I agree. It serves as a launching point for so many other questions and research, as we saw here in this session. So thank you so much for sharing your methodologies and the issues that you came across and discussing these with us here today. And I would invite everybody to come back next month for our presentation with Olaf Sawicki-Richter from the Distance University of Hagen. He'll be summarizing a series of three studies to explore the field of distance education research. So we hope you can come back and join us for that. And that is on June 2nd, same time, same place. So good afternoon to everybody, and take care.
Yes, thank you, everybody. And I would just point out, if you did early on mouse over my name and got an email address, I noticed it was incorrect. So if you do want to send me something, you should mouse over again right now and make sure you pick up the correct email address. And I certainly, if anybody wishes to contact me further about the studies I've been doing, and then I'd be happy to respond to you. So thank you for everybody for taking part today.
Actually, that reminds me, Jeff, very early on in the session when you were talking about your courses that you're teaching right now, there was a couple of people who had asked if you had some of the course material online, or maybe it was even Wendy who's still here who had a question.
Wendy, if that was your question, then I'm here for a little while longer. If you want to let me know exactly what you're looking for, I can hopefully give you something.
Actually, now I'm looking, I think the two people who had asked questions about that have left the room, so hopefully they'll take the initiative and look on the Queen's website at those courses.
I'll download the, or capture the chat messages and see if I can locate who it was and respond to them if I can. So, yes, I'll try and follow up on that, Lynn.
Great. Thank you for Jeff. I'm sure if it, they can also contact you, too. So don't go to too much work. You've already done a lot for us.
Thank you very much for your support, Lynn, and I will sign off now.
Thank you, Jeff. It was an excellent session, and I'll ask everybody else who's still in the room to finish up your texting and leave the room in the next few moments, because I can't actually make the recording until everybody's left the room. So I'll give you a few minutes, and then I'm going to have to virtually give you the boot.